This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
When we think about care and commitment, these are sometimes elusive things in our culture. I think the Queen Bee, Beyonce, said it best in Single Ladies when she appealed to her ex-boyfriend getting jealous when she got a new boyfriend and said, "Hey, if you like it, then you should have put a ring on it." Right? That's the idea, right? When we're committed to someone, when we're devoted to a group of people, we have reasonable expectations as to what that commitment looks like. And usually that's expressed in care. So businesses have reasonable expectations for their customers. They can't read our minds. They just have reasonable expectations that we'll be able to clearly articulate what we want, and they'll be able to deliver that. Parents probably have expectations for their kids to act a certain way in exchange for providing them shelter and home and good things. There's all kinds of social contracts that happen in a thousand different ways every day. So like, let's say you're stuck in a traffic jam. The reasonable expectation is that you're going to let one person out in front of you. Not that you're pausing means whoever is in line can come on in. Right? It's a one car deal, usually. So we have a sense of how care is coupled up to commitment. So what do you think about God's care and his commitment to his people? What does God's care look like? What does his devotion to his people look like? When the children of Israel entered the promised land, God had directed them to a way of living that would lead to blessing. He said, just walk in this way and your life will be blessed. I'll take care of you. I'll go before you. I'll be behind. I'll take care of you. I'll do all this. And rather than walking in God's ways and staying devoted to him, they chose to put their eyes on the other nations. They wanted what they had. Those other nations had gods that gave them liberties to do whatever they wanted. And so the children of Israel looked at that and said, well, that's a cool deal. Look at how they're living. Man, that'd be fun. Yeah, God brought us out of Egypt, but we're settled here in the promised land now. We can do whatever. Those false gods weren't so intrusive into their way of living. It's almost as if the God of Israel cramped their style. They wanted to live a certain way. And as the ending of Judges horrifically shows, everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. So does God care? Is he going to intervene? Does he care for people that are hurting in the midst of all this as people are doing their own thing and going after all kinds of false gods and just living however they want, doing what's right in their own eyes? Well, these questions existed back in that day, and they're relevant for us today too, right? So maybe in light of current happenings in the world, in our world, on the issue of abortion, for instance, we may wonder, does God care? Does he even see this? How long is he going to put up with sloppy leadership on these issues? Is he going to come through? Is he going to execute justice and mercy? So this passage that we're going to jump into today kind of has that, that's what's going on in the air as we jump into verse 1 of 1 Samuel 1. Last week we introduced this series on 1 and 2 Samuel. We saw that there's some amazing characters involved, that there's lots of action and drama, and there's even a longing for a true king. I summarized the series as the rise and fall of King David, and he's not quite on the scene yet here. He's going to show up in chapter 15, but we're building to that. Things are happening in our passage today to get us there. And today we're going to wrestle with that question, does God care? Does God care? And I hope you'll dig into this passage and see that he does indeed care. You may be here today and wonder whether or not God is even real, let alone caring. As one author put it, if there's no one other than other human beings who care about the human race and the individuals who comprise it, that's one thing. If that's the truth, then our hopes rest on the best and the wisest people we can find. But if there's a God who does care about these things, we would be very foolish to carry on as though that were not true. In other words, we should listen to him. If there's a God in heaven who does indeed care about what goes on this earth, then shouldn't we do well to listen to him? Shouldn't we do more than just hope that somehow humanity is going to get it right sometime? Shouldn't we look to him? And so today, I hope you can see that God does care, and I hope this leads to faith and worship from you. And as you believe in this and know that God cares, you may be in a desperate place like Hannah is at the beginning of our story today. And I hope you're encouraged today to look to God, that He does care and He will come through. So ask Him. Cast your cares on Him. He cares for you. So today, I invite you to join me as we see five ways that God demonstrates His care for His people. Five ways God demonstrates His care for His people. So we have a lot of scripture reading to do in these two chapters. And let's begin in 1 Samuel 1 and let's read verses 1 through 8. So follow along with me as I read. Here's what we read beginning in verse 1. There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim in the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephrathite. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. On that day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he would give a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. And so it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Then Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? So this is God's word. Thanks be to God. Five ways that God demonstrates His care for His people. And I stopped in verse 8. That's the first section we're going to look at. God demonstrates care as God acts in the midst of distress. God acts in the midst of distress. So in verses 1 through 8, it's not readily apparent that God cares, is it? We're jumping into this passage and we just meet a man in the opening verse. And there's not really anything that pops about this man. All these terms don't really mean much of anything to us, right? A man of Ramathaim Zophim, in the hill country of Ephraim. His name's Elkanah. We're given something of his heritage. Son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, and a Ephrathite. So, cool. What a great guy. We know if we research this in the book of Chronicles that Elkanah was from the tribe of Levi, which kind of proves significant later in the passage. And he's an Ephrathite. That's significant because Bethlehem dwells in the region of Ephrathah. We're also told he has two wives, Peninnah, which her name means a slab that you put a sandwich in and slam closed. No, that's not true. That's a panini. This is Peninnah. Her name means fruitful, and it's probably reflected in the fact that she has children, lots of them. And then we meet this other wife named Hannah, whose name means faithful. Hannah is part of the fellowship of the barren. She doesn't have any children. The Lord has closed her womb. We're told that emphatically, right? The Lord had closed her womb, and her rival provoked her because the Lord had closed her womb. So, I think I need to say just pastorally here that hearing Hannah's story may mean that some in this room are brought face to face with struggles that you have related to barrenness, that you want to have children and you can't, and you've tried, and you've wondered, God, how long? And this story seems very personal for you, as if like, does Phil know this struggle, and is this why he chose this? Is there something here for me? And I think Jen Wilkins said it best when she said, I want to give you permission to exhale a little bit. While this story is about an individual dealing with personal grief that the Lord spoke into, there's a bigger thing going on here, and we don't want to miss that. So just breathe, okay? It's okay. This isn't trying to put the highlight on you. It's not trying to give you a secret that's going to unlock all the barrenness for you. It's showing us that Hannah was barren, and it's significant in the Old Testament whenever there's a woman who's barren. There's many who probably struggled with this, and the spotlight is dropped here. Why? We've had some barren women throughout Scripture. So we have women like Sarah, Abraham's wife, who was barren. Remember when she bore a child finally in her old age? Right? Wasn't she 90 Am I getting the age right? Does someone know that? 90. So then then Isaac married Rebekah. Rebekah was barren for a while. Then Jacob's wife Rachel was barren. Then we have Samson's mother, Samuel's mother, all the way to the birth of John the Baptist. Remember that we looked at in Luke 1, that we're told that she who was called barren is now bore a child in her own age. There's something that God's doing in each of these stories. He's dropping the spotlight so that we can see, I'm up to something. I'm caring. Okay, there's something that's happening here. That's why the spotlight's getting dropped here. Often in the Bible, a barren woman means God is up to something big. And so it's fitting that the story would begin here. But year after year, this family went to worship God at Shiloh. You might remember from Judges that Shiloh was the place where the tabernacle was located. This would have been like going to Jerusalem later in the Bible, where the temple would be built. Going to Shiloh is where the tabernacle was, so this is where they would go to worship. And another insight, too, that you might think about, that I've been trying to think about, because I've grown up in church all my life, and I can read things in the Bible like Lord, I can read things like Lord of Hosts, and it doesn't, you know, it's just like, oh yeah, God, okay, of course. And when you see Lord, especially in your Bible, if it's in all caps, Lord is meant to speak of Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God of Israel. And when you read Lord of Hosts and Lord is in all caps, you should really read that Yahweh of Armies. That's what host is. It's meaning that God has a force. God has a host of angels that are at his disposal. He has armies that are at his disposal. The Lord of Armies. That's what you should read when you see Lord of Hosts. It's Yahweh of Armies. So Lord of Hosts can, I think, easily become just, oh yeah, we've kind of said that our whole life and we've lost sight of it. This family would go to Shiloh to worship Yahweh of Armies. And we're told that Hophni and Phinehas were priests there. So when Elkanah sacrificed, he would distribute portions to Peninnah and her family and all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion. He loved Hannah. He wanted to lavish that on her. He wanted her to say, your barrenness doesn't, you know, determine my love for you. I love you. I'll give you a double portion. That was significant. And he also communicated that to her. But Yahweh, the Lord, had closed her womb. And we have Peninnah here rubbing this in, provoking her, irritating her. After all, the Lord had closed her womb. Year after year. I wonder if sometimes they even showed up at Shiloh and Peninnah was pregnant. And she would maybe just put her hands on her belly and say, oh, Hannah, could you help me here? Oh, this is such a burden to bear, this child that I'm carrying. You know what that's like. Oh, wait, no, you don't. I wonder if that just happened year after year. I wonder if that was just rubbed in year after year. I mean, just imagine how that pestering continued. And Hannah wept and wouldn't eat. She's devastated and in great distress. So Elkanah continues trying to comfort her, to lavish love on her. Verse 8, you might read that and be like, who does this jerk think he is? Like, I'm better to you than 1,000 sons. Boy, he sounds like a real winner. And it's just because that's not the way we talk in this day and age. He's really, if you can read the original language there, you even read some commentaries about this. He's not being that way, sarcastic about it. He's really genuinely using an idiom of the day to say, listen, more than having offspring to me is having you. I love you. He's trying to communicate that to her. But there's deep hurt here. We don't want to minimize that. And it's in the midst of this kind of distress that God's going to act. And it continues, secondly, in verses 9 through 20, as God remembers the prayer of the afflicted. So follow along with me as I begin reading in verse 9. After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord, and she was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly, and she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, Yahweh of armies, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. And as she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, How long are you going to go on being drunk? Put away your wine away from you. But Hannah answered, "No, my Lord, I'm a woman troubled in spirit. I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I've been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I've been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation." And Eli answered, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him." And she said, "Let your servant find favor in your eyes." And then the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. They rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah, and Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her, and in due time Hannah conceived and bore a son. And she called his name Samuel, for she said, "I have asked for him from the Lord." So God remembers the prayers of the afflicted. After eating, Hannah roses, and then we meet this other big character in these first two chapters, this character of Eli, and he's sitting on a seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. Hannah's distressed, and so she vows in verse 11, "Yahweh of armies, if you'll look upon the affliction of your servant, remember me and don't forget me and give me a son, then I'll give him to Yahweh all the days of his life, and no razor will touch his head." This sounds a lot like the children of Israel crying out in Egypt. If you went back and looked at Exodus 3:7, you might remember, "How long, O Lord, listen to the affliction of your people? How long are we going to have to do this?" And God heard the affliction of his people. It's just how her prayer sounds. She promises, "This child is going to be about you, not me. It's going to be about you, God. You can do this." In fact, we're told that this child would be a Nazarite. That's what's going on with no razor ever touching his head. Readers of this would know, it's a Nazarite vow that they're going to take. That it's going to, Nazarite just means kind of set apart or consecrated to the Lord. And we have other people in Scripture who took Nazarite vows who were both born to barren women. People like Samson and John the Baptist, notably. But they wouldn't serve like priests as Samuel would. So this is really significant for Samuel. And so she prays, and she was speaking in her heart, but her lips were moving and her voice wasn't heard. And Eli noticed this and thought she was drunk. "So put away your wine," he says to her. But she just says, "I'm desperate. Yahweh has to intervene. Yahweh has to come through for me. There's no other place I can go for help." And so Eli gave her this blessing. And what he literally says here, "Go in peace. May the God of Israel grant your asking that you have asked of him." May the God of Israel grant your asking that you've asked of him. That's in verse 17. This asking is a huge thing. Asking is the Hebrew word. You could write this in your notes. S-A-apostrophe-A-L. That's the Hebrew word. S-A-apostrophe-A-L. Asking. It's probably the most used word here in chapter 1. And if you tried to say that word, what does it sound like? I mean, just, I don't know if you want to whisper it under your breath or try to say it out loud to your neighbor right in this moment, but Saul, Saul, who does that sound like? Saul. Okay, so it sounds like who's going to be Israel's first king. And what's significant about who did the asking for that? The people of Israel, the children of Israel asked, "We want to be like the other nations." And so God kind of gives them what they ask for. And here, God gives Hannah what she asks for. And her motive is not the other nations. Her motive is God. This is about you. Keep your promise to your people. Come near to me in my distress. God's answering. God has to come through. And she even receives that blessing in verse 18. "Let your servant find favor in your eyes." A lot like Mary responding to the angel in Luke 1. "Let it be to me according to your word." So she goes away and she's no longer upset. They rose early. They return home. Elkanah knew his wife. Yahweh remembered her. So, we have this blessing. We have Yahweh remembered her. We have Samuel coming and Samuel is born. Samuel, by the way, means his name is God. And it's really close to asking. There's just an M in there. So it's the same kind of thing. His name is God. "I asked God for this child and God delivered." So in the midst of this distress, God had remembered his afflicted people. And as a result of this, then, the chapter ends. Chapter 1 ends, thirdly, by us seeing that God receives worship through Samuel's service. God receives worship through Samuel's service. So here's what we pick up the action in verse 21. The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow, but Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, "As soon as the child is weaned, I'll bring him so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever." Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him, only may the Lord establish his word." So the woman remained and nursed her son until she had weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a three-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. The child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, "Oh, my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I'm the woman who was standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he has lent to the Lord." And he worshiped the Lord there. So chapter 1 wraps, and we have this dedication of God's gift back to God. Elkanah and his house return for their yearly worship, but Hannah waits until the child's weaned, and she knows he's going to be there forever. And so Elkanah agreed with that plan, asked for God's blessing on it. She weaned him, brought him up to sacrifices to the Lord in Shiloh. We're told the child was young. They offered sacrifices and offered Samuel to Eli. And then she reminds Eli that she was the one who was praying to the Lord on that day, going back to that time when she prayed and Eli had blessed her. And then what doesn't really come out in our English translations, but we have this amazing recap in verses 27 and 28. So look over verse 27 as I read what it says kind of in the original language. Here's what she says. "For this child I prayed, and Yahweh gave me my asking, which I asked from him. And I also have given back what was asked to Yahweh. All the days that he lives, he is the one that I asked for Yahweh." So, there's a lot of asking, right? That's how the chapter ends with all that. That doesn't come out in our English translation, but that's the point of this text. She asked, and God showed he cared. And now Samuel's there worshiping the Lord. The child's presence pointed to something that God has done. So we've met some amazing characters in chapter 1, right? We've met Elkanah, we have Peninnah, we have Hannah, we have Samuel, Eli, Hophni, Phinehas. We have all these characters. And the main character that's on the move is God, right? God had closed the womb, and now God had opened it. God's up to something. God's the one who receives worship at the end of the chapter. So God's demonstrated his care for his people. Well, I do want to turn to chapter 2 because this is still moving. The action's still happening. And as we turn the corner into chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, we see forth that God receives praise through Hannah's prayer. God receives praise through Hannah's prayer. So God had received worship through Samuel's service, him being devoted to the Lord there. And now God receives praise through Hannah's prayer. And here's what she prays in beginning in verse 1 of chapter 2. Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, and those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, and she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor, makes rich. He brings low, and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He'll guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed." So without missing a beat, Hannah's heart bursts in praise to God. She prays this amazing prayer of praise to God. I mean, I don't know if you could come up with this on the spur of the moment if I said, "Hey, why don't you pray today?" And then out of your heart would just flow this. I mean, this is pretty amazing, right? That this would flow out of her heart. And so I've summarized this prayer in two ways. First of all, She prays and praises God that God came through in her crisis. So her heart exults in Yahweh and her horn is exalted in Him. Her mouth derides her enemies, maybe Peninnah. You know, no longer can she talk and taunt me because the Lord has given me a child now, right? That's kind of the impression. She rejoices in her salvation, almost this micro salvation that God had come through in the nitty gritty of her life. And there is no one who compares with God. No one is holy like Him. He's like a rock. So in her prayer, she chides the arrogant. She calls on them, don't be angry, arrogant, or prideful, because God has knowledge and He'll act accordingly. Those who think they're strong can actually be shown to be weak before Him. She was the barren one. At the end of verse 5, see this? She who is barren now has borne 7 children. In other words, I think that's numeric, you know, pointing that God, you know, God, you've done completely what you said you would do. Born 7 children. God's had a perfect way in her. And God will have His way. God kills and brings to life. He brings down the high and raises up the lowly. He makes poor and He makes rich. He brings low and He exalts. And He does all this because He's in control. It's not like He's just rolled the dice and said, well, let's figure out what's going to happen in this world. No. Hannah's praying and saying, God, You can control all this. You're the one that's in charge. You coming through in my world, Hannah's praying, is just how You are in this world overall. Your will be done here just like it is in heaven. That's what she's saying. And so because of this then, she has confidence that God will not only come through for her, but God will come through for the nation through His king. So at the end of verse 10, we're told that, right? And it should strike us just real strange, like, king? They don't have any king. What is she talking about? So at the end of verse 10, God will give strength to His king and exalt the horn of His anointed. So there's also a micro salvation in her world, but then there's this macro salvation that God's going to come through for all kinds of people. And He's going to do it in an amazing way. There's a bigger salvation, that He will guard the feet of His faithful ones and the wicked will be cut off. And this won't be by man's might. We're not going to be able to look at all this and say, man, that's really something that mankind pulled off. We're going to look at this and say, God, look what God has done. This is incredible. He'll break His enemies to pieces and accomplish His victory as He will. So God's praise from Hannah's lips then points to much of what's going to happen in the rest of the book of 1 Samuel, right? And 2 Samuel. That God's going to have His way. We're still getting oriented almost to what's going to shake down here, but we're kind of knowing, okay, God's going to have a king. God's going to protect that king somehow. He's going to raise him up. So who is this? Is it Saul, the asked for one? Is it David? Is it someone else? So Hannah's prayer ends with this, that the reader doesn't know what's going on here, but Hannah's prayer ends with this confidence that God's king will emerge victorious, and it's going to happen because of God Himself. So Hannah gives praise to God. So now we have to turn the corner to wrap up this chapter. It's pretty amazing. So far we've seen desperation, and we've seen God showing that He cares, coming through to provide, and even leading back to praise to Him from all these different ways. But we may wonder, like, why is this such a big deal? Right? What's going on here? So there's someone faithfully serving God and praise going up to Him. Isn't this always the case? Right? So we may think that. You may think, what's the big deal, Hannah? So God's going to come through. You act like the world's fallen to pieces. And their world was. So we have to understand that. We have to take a dark turn here at the end of chapter 2 to see how God had to act and that His care is bigger than just Hannah. God working in the midst of Hannah, yes, comes through in an amazing way for her desperate situation. But it's so much bigger than that. And we need the end of chapter 2 to help us see that. And coming through for her, God's also coming through for His people. And this is seen in our last point here, that God foils corrupt leadership through Samuel's faithfulness. God foils corrupt leadership through Samuel's faithfulness. As we transition into the rest of this chapter, it's dark. It's really dark. And the final section kind of hangs together structurally. If you were going to pin it all together, there's some structural markers. And so I've tried to kind of make my points where those structural markers are. But it begins in verse 11, right? So Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. The boy. So this is Samuel here. You might even highlight verse 11, that the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. That's the structural marker. Samuel serves in the midst of priestly sin. Samuel's serving God in the presence of Eli. And this is significant because Samuel's serving in the midst of all this sin, priestly sin, moral sin. So this comes up in verses 12 through 21. This is why it's so wicked. And I think there's a sense in which as we read this, we're going to get to things and you just may feel like almost throwing up. Like this is so despicable and horrible and awful. But we have to see, this is why Samuel's coming is such a huge deal. So let's pick it up in verse 12. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. So just imagine that, if we could stop there. Like imagine having someone as your pastor, the priest of the nation, and this is what's said of them. They were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. Here's what it looked like. The custom of the priests, verse 13. The custom of the priests with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." And if the man said to him, "Let them burn the fat first, and then take as much as you wish," he would say, "No, you must give it now. And if not, I'll take it by force." Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy clothed with a linen ephod, and his mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord." So then they would return to their home. Indeed, the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters, and the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. So Samuel serves in the midst of moral sin. So we're back to Hophni and Phinehas here. They were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. And here's how wicked they were. The custom of the priests was that, according to Leviticus 7, verses 28 to 36, that might be the verse to put in your notes, they could receive a breast and a right leg of whatever was being offered. That was the priest's allotment. But they were arrogant. Their servant would come with this three-pronged fork, thrust it in, and all that the fork grabbed, they grabbed. So, I mean, just think about that. You're coming to worship God, and you got this fork getting in the way. You're getting forked. I mean, it's just a mess. It's awful. I mean, they're coming and doing this, and you're coming with an offering to atone for your sins. And these people are just being selfish and wanting some for themselves. It's a mess. So, getting in the way. And then in verse 15, the fat was burned, and they would demand the fat. They would demand that. The fat belonged to the Lord. That was the significance. That was the pleasing aroma to him, is that fat sizzled. They were getting fat on the Lord's fat, and they were doing this by force if necessary. So they were arrogant, mighty, and wicked. And remember, Hannah has just prayed that God would bring these groups down. Their sin was great because they treated God's offering with contempt. But there's the contrast in verse 18, right? Samuel was ministering before the Lord. a boy clothed in a linen ephod. So he's already dressed like a priest. His mother provided this for him in yearly visits, and God's kindness was evident. Eli would bless them. Eli would bless them. May the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord. There's asking again. That's what Hannah's always doing. She's asking. She's needy. And Yahweh provides more children. So the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. Samuel continues to serve and grow with judgment looming. In verse 26, we see that. And the passage that builds up to it. In verse 22, now Eli was very old. And he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all of Israel and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all these people. No, my sons, it's no good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they wouldn't listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. Now the boy Samuel continued to grow, both in stature and in favor with the Lord and also with man. So there's the contrast again, right? And do you get what's happening? Eli's old in verse 22, and he keeps hearing that all his sons are doing in Israel. And look at the offense in verse 23, laying with women who were serving in the temple, or verse 22. Using their position and authority to take advantage of people. And not only did it displease Eli, for he asked why they did such things and tried to help them see they were sinning against God. They weren't just sinning against God, but they were sinning against the people. And they refused to listen to their father, and were told in good Old Testament bluntness as to why. For it was the will of Yahweh to put them to death. So we have to come to terms with that. Like, there's a reason why God is right to take down the prideful. And it's because they're making themselves God. And he has no rivals. Judgment or justice is God, is God's, and he will repay. He will right that wrong. But in this moment, our attention is drawn back to Samuel, right? The boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and with man. Sounds a lot like somebody else we've heard about in the New Testament. And finally, chapter 2 comes to a close. When a man of God shows up, so verse 27, there came a man of God to Eli and said to him, thus says the Lord, did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt, subject to the house of Pharaoh? Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest and to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? I gave to the house of your father all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel. Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded from my dwelling and honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel? Therefore the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promise that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. Then in distress you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. And this shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. This shall be a sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. And I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what's in my heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my anointed forever. And everyone who is left in your house shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf or a bread, and shall say, please put me in one of the priest's palaces that I may eat a morsel of bread. And then the shoe drops into chapter 3. Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli. So all that section is held together. the house of Eli's father was Aaron himself. That's when the priesthood was established. He was chosen to be a priest and wear the ephod. God had entrusted these offerings to this house, and Eli's failure with his sons, in a sense failing to take them out and remove them as priests, meant that God would act. And it's direct, right? Verses 30 through 34 tell us that God would end the charade of this priesthood. And then a deeper word comes from God in verses 35 and 36. Did you catch that when we read it? His purpose would triumph. He would raise up a faithful priest, doing what's in God's heart and mind, built on a sure house, who would go in and out before his anointed forever. Even Eli's house would come and want to be served by this priesthood. So there's a lot of debate as to who he's talking about here, who this man of God is, who this prophet is that shows up and gives this word. Samuel's certainly going to be a shadow of it. He's going to be faithful. But his children are train wrecks too. They're not going to follow his ways. 2 Samuel's going to end with a priest named Zadok who appears to be faithful. It's probably pointing to a priest we meet in the New Testament. In Hebrews 2:17, one who was made like his brothers in every respect so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. And then in chapter Hebrews 7, verses 26 through 28, it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weaknesses as high priest, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever, and that's Jesus. Jesus is the priest who will fulfill this. And we have this faithful Samuel here. The boy Samuel was ministering in the presence of Eli. So this is what God's up to. Into this mess, God's answering the needs of a barren woman to raise up someone who's going to be faithful in the midst of this. And it's bigger than just her. It's about his people. It's about the mess going on with this nation. God has to foil the corrupt leadership, and he's going to do it through Samuel's faithfulness. So, man, I know that's a marathon through those two chapters quickly. I knew I had 7 more pages of notes than I normally have on a Sunday morning, so I knew this was going to be crazy, but we're getting our bearings as to why this is so significant. Next time we'll be in chapter 3 and just what's going on when God's calling Samuel. What's going on there? But today, let's wrap all this up. We've seen 5 ways that God demonstrates his care for his people. He acts in the midst of distress. He remembers the prayers of the afflicted. He receives worship through Samuel's service. He receives praise through Hannah's prayer. And he foils corrupt leadership through Samuel's faithfulness. It's not foiled yet, but by chapter 4 and 5 it will be. That's where, well, you'll just have to read it. So throughout this passage, we've seen God's care on display. He comes through for the distressed and the afflicted. He answers prayer. He's worshipped for his actions. He even steps in when leadership is going off the rails to seemingly say, enough, I'm going to execute justice right now. And even through all this, God's about something even bigger. God's helping us long for his nearness. He's putting in our hearts a desire to ask for his help for care in this messed up world. And he's even sending his help by promising us a righteous ruler. He's doing all these things. And God's done this ultimately by sending his son. He is the king who would reign forever. He's the priest who would faithfully serve both our interests as people and God's interests as a perfectly holy and righteous God. So today you'll find no savior like him. There's no one who has those kind of credentials. There's no one who could step in and perfectly represent man and perfectly represent God the way Jesus does. So when the world is falling apart, as Hannah prayed, he's the rock. There's no rock like our God, and Jesus is the rock you can stand on. Jesus is the one you can put your confidence in. So when this world with all that's going on in it is messed up, where do you put your confidence? Where are you going to go? What are you going to put your confidence in? That's the issue. And what I think these first two chapters are saying is, lean into God. He's the one who cares. And he cares in such a multifaceted way. He cares in a way that's going to execute perfect justice against those who are just nuts. He cares in a way that he can come near, and even in meeting the needs of Hannah, meet our needs. I mean, it's so incredible that he could do this. That when Samuel comes and Samuel serves faithfully, that's going to tip the scales so that one day Jesus is going to come. All this is going to happen through Samuel's faithfulness. So put your hope and trust in the one who cares for you. And if you're a believer, you know and trust him, you may have a hard time at times leaning into him. Circumstances of life just overwhelm you. Or there may be something going on in your life and you just may, I don't know if I can trust God with that or not. Would you look at the example that Hannah gives us here? I mean, just the emphatic asking. I mean, could you just pester God to death about the stuff that concerns you? I mean, I think that would be a great application of this, right? Rather than ranting to everybody else in the world about what needs to be done in our world, what if you just ranted to God for 5 seconds? Or, as much time as you rant to others, right? And you may say, well, I just don't feel like that's right. It is actually right, and we just don't focus on it enough. It's a biblical category called lament. Lament. We have a whole book of the Bible called Lamentations. That's just Jeremiah's lament for all that's going on. We have Psalms that express corporate lament. Psalms 44, 60, 74, 79, 80, 85, 90. Grab one of those Psalms when you're overwhelmed with the stuff of this world and cry out to God, execute justice. Are you not going to come through for your people? How long are you going to stand for this? This is the kind of thing that we can cry out to God, and it's a biblical category of just lament. Just let him know your troubles. So these, cast your cares on him. That's the first Peter passage, right? Casting all your cares on him because he cares for you. So, I mean, there's all kinds of applications in this passage, but I think that's a big one that stands out. Just when the cares of this world overwhelm you, would you just cry out to God and ask for those? So other applications here. What else might God want us to see? How might Samuel be positioned to help us see what God's doing? What are the bigger things that are happening? God cares, and so God acts, and God begins to do something big. Let's anticipate this as we continue in this book, that we may glorify and enjoy him forever.